Broadcasted live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
Well, as you know, on a Monday, we usually speak to people who are making a difference. And I think this is one such person who very, very quietly is going about changing the face of education in South Africa, the way in which children are reading and learning and are teaching. Teachers are teaching how to read, especially indigenous languages. Elena Sisulu, as you know, is an activist. Many of you will know her for many, many of her other roles. But Puku is an organization that she started to really, really do the hard work, grassroots level type of work of getting children to read. Read for meaning, especially in their indigenous languages. They publish books. They make sure that the content on those books is appropriate just to help our children get going with that really big mammoth task of reading. We know that we were told about 80 plus percentage of grade 4 learners in South Africa, around about 10-year-olds, are not reading for meaning. And those numbers we'll discuss with her just now. But I mean, what's important is that somebody's doing something about it. Mom, Illinois, thank you so much for making time for us. Good evening and welcome. Mama Illinois, hello? Okay, I think she's... Let's try that again. I think we had her just now in a few seconds ago, literally. Mama Eleanor, hello. Are you able to hear us? Literally a few seconds ago, she was online. I don't know what's happened. But the name of her organization, the foundation that she runs, is called Puku, P-U-K-U. And the work that they do is absolutely phenomenal. You may know that 2022 to 2032 was declared the year of the indigenous language by the United Nations. And one of the things that was really, really important, and people like her have taken this up, is to say, yes, it's the year of the indigenous language, but what are we doing, you know, to elevate our indigenous languages. They, as Puku, they publish books. They make sure that the kind of content that goes into children's books is the kind of content that is going to elevate our languages quite some. There is a book that they've just published, which I'm really, really excited about. It's written in Ngu, and alongside the Ngu language, is a translation. So on the one side of the page is Ngu language, and then on the other side of the page is either English, Afrikaans, Zulu, Xhosa, Setswana, Sesotho, Venda, and so on. And the idea is for us all to be able to get a sense of a language that we may not be familiar with. And they also try to make sure that while we are able to buy a book, we must also perhaps get someone to read it for us. So there was an initiative to try and get that also on YouTube, so that the reading of it in Ngu, so that we can hear it ourselves, happens virtually, which I think is absolutely exciting. Let's just try and see if we do have Mom Eleanor on the line. Are you able to hear us, Mom Eleanor?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much for making time for us. I'm so sorry. Good evening and welcome. Thank you for making time.
It's a pleasure.
So let's just
talk. And I'm sorry I couldn't be with you in the studio.
No. It's absolutely okay. And, you know, thank you really for honoring the invitation. Let's just maybe talk about Puku and your vision for Puku.
Okay, so firstly, I must just correct something. Puku doesn't publish books. We work with publishers,
okay,
and we promote books. And I would describe us as a data aggregator.
Mm.
We work with publishers to promote and make sure that we digitally capture books that are published.
Mm-hmm.
And get them reviewed, because we believe there's not enough reviewing of books.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the best way you can learn to read for meaning, is to review books.
Mm.
So for example, now one of our major projects is to do catalogs of children's books in the nine officially indigenous languages, and to do for ECD and foundation phase. So our job is really to make it easier for parents, teachers, caregivers, families to find the books in all languages.
Mm. You've also come across a project, and I've partnered with other partners, stakeholders, to assist with teachers training for helping young children to read for meaning. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, well, we do book review workshops, and last year we were honored and privileged to partner with Rhodes University with the B.Ed Foundation Phase program to do workshops for the teachers to do book reviews. And because we believe that teachers must be familiar with the literature, the children's books that are available in the country locally, and understand, be able to choose books, be able to review them. Because if they are not reading those books, then there's little chance that the children will read the books. Mm. So it's to help children to teachers to read, review, and to find books, so that by the time they become they qualify as teachers and go into the classroom, they have a good knowledge of what is available and what their children should be reading.
That figure
in all languages.
Yes, the figure that I mentioned earlier on, and of course, there's always a debate about how accurate that number is. 80% plus of our students in grade four don't know how to read for meaning. Others contest that, but the point is that it's dire. The situation is dire, and something needs to be done about it. Your sense of how do we begin? I mentioned the fact that the work that you do goes some way in helping us getting out of that mess. But your sense of what has to be done to help our children read for meaning?
Yes, well, there's a whole ecosystem. Puku is just one of many organizations that are doing different things. And for us, we feel it's important not to reinvent the wheel and to try to fill in a gap of something that's not being done. So that's why we focused on actually reviewing books and making books more discoverable. And we're building a platform a digital platform to be able to do this, so that parents, and we hope that it will be soon, so that people can find books more easily that they need in whatever language. And we link this to publishers so that we can drive traffic to the publishers and people can buy the books. We also catalyze production of books. Though I say we're not a publisher, but I should explain this a little bit. We do these workshops, writing and review workshops. And when we get manuscripts, we in this instance, we got Omar Katrina to narrate a story. And because there were no books in Nyi, we got the story prepared, translated, done multilingually, and partnered with New Africa Books on this. So in some instances, we will follow up with a publication and play a bigger role in publishing a book ourselves. But mostly we want to work with publishers and promote the books that they have published. I think the thing about children reading, there's been a big focus on teachers, that the teachers, for children to read, teachers must read. As Sindiwe Magona famously said, you can't infect people with a disease that you don't have. Similarly, if you as a teacher don't read and are not enthusiastic about it and don't enjoy reading, you're not going to pass on that enjoyment. You can't pass it on to children. So teachers are a major target group, I think, at this point, not only from Puku, but the reading panel as well has emphasized that teacher trainees they must be capacitated. They must know how to teach how to read. And recently, the reading panel under Phumzile Mlambo-Nyoka, the former deputy president, and the person who convened the reading panel, brought together the deans of education from the different universities, heads of department in the different provinces, to discuss and reflect on what needs to be done. So that's one strategy, is to focus on teachers, teacher trainings, and then also teachers in practice. The other is just to make books more available.
You've been doing a lot of work in, and I said earlier on, maybe you were not already with us, but the fact that 2022 to 2032 had been declared as the Indigenous decade, language decade by the UN, and then yes. A lot of the work that you've done is to also encourage reading in Indigenous languages. You've just spoken about Oma Katrina, who collaborated with you in that Ngu book, but just maybe a sense of how we would all of us participate in encouraging and elevating our Indigenous languages. For instance, you know, I'm not sure that our universities and other institutions recognize the work that she has been able to do in contributing to elevating the Ngu language, even though she herself is not literate in the Western sense, but is the custodian of the language.
Yes, actually we partnered with UNISA on the 21st of February on International Mother Language Day to celebrate, to honor her as part of International Mother Language Day, but also to celebrate her 91st birthday. Oh, she lovely. Turned 91 oh, on lovely. the 4th of February.
Yes.
And I think UNISA, you know, takes language very seriously, and they have the biggest African language department in the country. But also, they focus, I mean, language is important in their other departments as well. And so UNISA, they were there up to the highest level to promote, and I think this is ongoing work. But I think I must say, part of the problem with languages and culture is that we have a Western academic paradigm that doesn't recognize Indigenous knowledge. And so Oma Katrina would, let me put it this way, the Ngu language wouldn't be in such dire straits if the people who spoke Ngu in 1994, when they started a kind of new language project, if all those people had been paid as teachers of the language. So our argument is that Oma should be recognized as a teacher of the language, and her granddaughter and David Van Wyk, the other two younger people who she's taught the language, should be recognized as teachers without her, because you know, there's no certificate. If you are the originator of the knowledge, who can set an exam to examine you and give you a certificate to make you a teacher? So they should be recognized as teachers. And this is as part of recognizing our Indigenous knowledge, because when you recognize as teacher, and if she had been paid as a teacher, she'd have been far more capacitated to do much more. Coming from a very materially deprived community, how she has managed to do what she's doing, do the language school, is like from project to project. She gets given a donation, and then they do some work, money runs out. And it's not a, and then I think the documentary that will be shown on the 29th of this month of September is by Gregory Molali, a very gifted filmmaker. Is going to show exactly the kind of things that the kind of hurdles in her way, and how she has struggled dealing with this thing to save her language. And really, money is a major issue in this whole issue. You ask me what can be done.
Yep.
And yes, there's a thing with teachers. You can provide more books. You can, you know, encourage parents to read. I think YouTube is a good, you know, building a great YouTube channel so that it can help. But I think really at the bottom of it is the lack of investment in these languages.
Would you say it's the same sort of problem that we have with translators, for instance, where, you know, with Indigenous languages, you're not getting, and I've heard horrific stories where people are just not getting paid their knowledge worth when it comes to translating the work, and just no real great value given to the people who take the pains to translate and interpret some of the works that is out there.
Yes, exactly. You know, if you look at Afrikaans, there was a political regime which favored Afrikaans as a language. But I think there was always a lot of investment into Afrikaans as a language. And even after that political support ended, the community, when I talk about the linguistic community, rather than, so the Afrikaans linguistic community buys Afrikaans books. They invest, they take children's books very seriously, and the fact that children need to learn in mother tongue. So they make sure that books are translated into Afrikaans and translators are paid. So it's possible to make a living. And if people could make a living being able to work, being able to translate, you know, often there's this kind of critique of black parents that, oh, you know, you just don't teach your children, you encourage them with English and all that. But it's an economic decision that people make. Mm. And if you could get a very good job in isiZulu, apart from teaching and lecturing, if you could, as a translator or as a proofreader, you know, all the many kind of jobs that there are in English or Afrikaans, our languages would be much more vibrant.
You say that about, you know, for instance, if you could get a good job in isiZulu or Xhosa, and it would be viable, that would be something that would encourage people to continue, in their mother tongue. But we've got a much more complex problem. We have said, for instance, in South Africa, you know, 11 languages are official, but people are still shy to, for instance, walk into a meeting and speak in their own indigenous language and hope that someone else, in fact, even if other people can hear, there is still that gap that we need to deal with as society about how we view our languages and how we are seen as people who practice our languages, not just in the classroom or in particular spaces, but openly in this country, even in office spaces.
Well, I don't think it's that people are shy. It's more that people are trained in English. Mm. So even if you speak your mother tongue, but when you learn, I remember once we were looking for someone, a copywriter for isiXhosa, because we had a book, we had a campaign, and I said this needs a copywriter. And there was this one woman, Xhosa speaking, who is trained copywriter, and I asked her, you know, can you do this for us? She says, you know, I've been trained in English. I haven't been trained in my language. If you think of any whether you be a social worker or a doctor or a nurse or a bank teller or whatever, you've been trained in English. So in a professional situation, you're not trained in your language. And we found this when during 2021 we had webinars, because of COVID, people couldn't have meetings. So we decided, it was during lockdown, and we decided, okay, we're going to have webinars in each language. For discussing this issue of reading and why aren't our children reading, and recognizing that within there should be a discourse within linguistic communities, an inter and intra-language engagement on this issue of children's reading. And it was quite fascinating. Many of the people said, you know, it's our first time actually having this discourse in our language. You know, even though they could have been professors of Setswana professor or Sepedi or Isindebele, it was the first time actually having a discussion completely in that language. And I think also we recognize the kind of hegemony of English, because when we had the one for the webinar for isiXhosa, then someone said, oh, why is there going to be English interpretation? And we said, no, this is for... It's going to be in this language. If it's isiZulu, it's going to be in isiZulu. We're not going to have interpretation. When you have English webinars, you don't have interpretation. And we just put it, and so, because there was this attitude, like, we won't understand. And we're saying, no, but, you know, this is, it doesn't matter if you don't understand, because it's not for you. It's for this linguistic community. And I think that's the thing also, that I think the attitude of English speakers is also leads to this. And there's a kind of arrogance that comes with the hegemony of English. And it's just, I understand recently in Parliament, they were one of the members couldn't do her what you call it, when you're sworn in.
Yes, I remember that. And they were asked to please do it in English. I saw that myself.
That is outrageous. Yeah. That and you see, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Because if that's Parliament.
Yeah.
Parliament has a budget, they have a language unit, they employ interpreters and translators, highly qualified people. In fact, we've worked with some of those people on the children's book camp thing. So in Parliament, they're supposed to have this. I mean, if you go to the UN, there's simultaneous interpretation. The technology is there. I mean, many decades ago, when I was a young person, I studied in West Africa, in Senegal, at an institute which was English-French. We had in the classroom simultaneous English-French translation. So it's not a difficult thing to do in Parliament, but I think it's that attitude of just denigrating our languages, and it impacts then on children's ability to read, because you schooled in mother tongue, and yet when you step into the classroom, you have to read in, and so you have a double burden of having to learn another language and to read in that, and to learn how to read.
What you're seeing also is when you look at our platforms, radio, television, and we do have them. Where, for instance, it's a Sesotho or Swana or Xhosa or Venda radio station. But what you're seeing now is a code switching thing happening, where we're not even strict about honoring the language properly in the radio station that is actually there to serve a particular language.
Yes, and I think those are things that really the investment, I can't emphasize enough the importance of radio. I really think that radio is part of the key. When you ask me what needs to be done, I really think that radio needs to be deployed much more. We need to have a dedicated program just dealing with this question of how do we get our children reading? And it should be done on each and every language platform. I think there's a big value to linguistic communities discussing amongst themselves. And these issues of code switching, of because code switching, I think it's fine in a conversational situation, but there's certain situations where people need to be corralled into having that discussion in whatever language it is. And, you know, I think people, because we've had this colonial imposition of English, that it even becomes just like, well, this is the way of being. Yet there are ways to, and I think radio is absolutely, absolutely important in doing this. And I really dream of a situation where each and every one of these language platforms, especially on the SABC, has a dedicated program having discussions. And having discussions of people, the adults in the community, the teachers, the librarians, the parents, the caregivers, the rural kind of wise people, the elders, all talking about this issue. That will make it an inclusive conversation. Right now, this conversation on reading is really mostly in English. The discourse on education is in English. And I think it's until you really get that conversation where people are brought in and brought in on an equal level. Because, you know, also language, it's also about power.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get into a situation like I'm talking to you here, I've got my master's degree, I'm very articulate. You put me in a situation of an isiZulu speaking thing, I'm tongue-tied. I'm at a disadvantage. The person from the rural area who has no matric is at an advantage over me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's a problem. There's a middle class issue that we face. And we need to unlock that and recognize people.
Yeah.
People's linguistic abilities. They may not have a matric, but they linguistically, they are far ahead of us and can articulate the issues of that community far better than we can. And I think unless we do that and kind of shift those power balances, we're always going to have a problem. And I think public education, the education in public schools as well, we need to, and I think middle class people, we're very guilty of this. As long as we're paying school fees for our own kids at a good school, that's it. But, you know, and if we're staying in the township and can afford to pay them to go to town to some Model C school, that's it. But we have to focus on the quality of education in all the schools and make sure all children have books that they need and all teachers are capacitated.
How do we support Puku?
I think one thing, there's the lowest hanging fruit in supporting Puku is to support the products. For example, the Tortoise and Ostrich book.
Yes.
I'd love people to buy that book.
Yes.
The more books are bought, the more it proves that we are achieving something and Omar Katrina gets some royalties.
Mm-hmm.
So it supports her.
Mm-hmm.
Also supporting on the 29th of September, the documentary is being shown over SABC on SABC. It'll be put out in social media for people to watch the documentary and understand the issues. And then also to visit our website. We've got a YouTube channel as well. And that is a support. And I think just consuming, buying more books in our languages, because we also, for us to get support, the kind of big support we need to show that we are impacting and people are buying more books. Because often we're told, oh, we don't publish in this book because there's no demand. We need to create the demand.
Absolutely. Really, really appreciate you giving us your time. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
And
thank
I really
you so appreciate
much.
Talking to you today. Eleanor Sisulu is the founder of Puku. It's PUKU, Children's Literature Foundation.
If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.